Hi, my name's Keith Nauheim, and we're here this afternoon at the 54th meeting of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons. We're going to talk about an issue today that's exploded across the country, that is the opioid epidemic, and we want to know how it's affected the thoracic surgical community and what thoracic surgeons are doing about it. I'm joined today by a group of three people who've had experience with treating the opioid patients and have specific opinions about how we should proceed from this point on. Would you like to introduce yourselves, David?
My name is David Cook. I'm a head of general thoracic surgery at UC Davis in Sacramento.
Hi, my name is Jim Lukatich. I'm head of the Department of Cardiothoracic Surgery at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center.
My name is Alex Brescia. I'm an integrated third-year cardiothoracic resident at the University of Michigan.
And I think I'd like to start off with you, Alex, because you presented a paper here about opioid usage in thoracic surgery, and it came out in your paper that some 1 out of 7, 14% of patients were still using opioids after surgery. Can you tell us a little bit about that, what the scope of the problem is?
Sure. So what we looked at were prescriptions that were filled after surgery. Everyone in the study fulfilled one prescription immediately after surgery related to the operation, and then a second prescription 3 to 6 months after that, when we would expect them not to need opioid medication anymore. And so what we found was 14% of lung cancer patients who did not use any opioids prior to surgery were still using an opioid prescription 3 to 6 months afterwards.
And were there any risk factors specific to that?
Yes, so the two strongest ones we found were adjuvant therapy and undergoing a thoracotomy. And within those findings, for adjuvant therapy, the risk factor strength was about equal for radiation or chemotherapy. Far more patients underwent chemotherapy than radiation therapy. And then the second strongest was undergoing a thoracotomy. And it was pretty significant.
Yep. David, you've had an interest in this topic. I guess I'd ask you how you all handle it in California. Do you limit the number of tablets prescribed? Do you follow those patients? Do you have an ongoing state registry where you keep track of them? How do you handle it now, and how do you think thoracic surgeons ought to handle this problem?
So in California, we do have a prescription registry when it comes to narcotics or opioids that we can look at to see if our patients have received an opioid prescription recently. So therefore, we don't make the mistake of double prescribing someone opioids. In regards to how many pills we discharge patients with, it's a very good question. And I think there's new data out there that say that as a surgical community, we are probably prescribing too many pills, and that really only about 28 to 30% of patients actually use all the pills that they are prescribed. And those pills stay in bathrooms and drawers and can be found and used for other reasons. One key thing that we do in order to set the expectation of pain and how pain is managed is we talk about acute pain and chronic pain during our informed consent process. And that way we can have a discussion at the top and at the beginning and a open, transparent level of expectations.
You know, Jim, you have a huge practice in foregut surgery, and the one of the symptoms of foregut surgery is the bloating and the nausea. Many of those things are side effects of narcotics, and I wonder how those fit into your practice specifically.
Yeah, so I have to break this down into how to handle patients that are coming to me already on narcotics, and then how do I handle my own role in trying to be responsible in managing those patients, but also managing those that come to me naive to antibiotics. In other words, I don't want to be one of those 15 or 30% of patients that I've induced to maybe have a narcotic problem. So I have two problems there. I'm seeing an increasing number, and I'm hearing statistics like 3% of all Americans are on chronic opioids. Okay. In my practice, I think it's higher, probably closer to 10% that are coming to me already on narcs. Never had surgery by me before, but they're already on the narcs. And then I have those that are naive to narcs, and what is my role there? So let me talk about the first group. That is those coming to me on narcotics, undergoing perhaps foregut surgery. Well, there's something called opioid-induced bowel dysfunction. And it's known now that opioids, chronic opioids, affect esophagus motility, gastric motility, small bowel motility, and large bowel in the form of constipation. Now, I think all of us know about constipation. It's common. 41% of patients on chronic NARCs complain of constipation. I think it's near 100% that they'll have some. So that's something that's been known. And I have experienced patients coming to me on NARCs, and I can track their GERD to the timing of their chronic constipation and their narcotic use. And these are the ones that should be a yellow flag, maybe a red flag to you. They come in, no big hiatal hernia, no chronic history of GERD, but it's all induced. And if you do a careful history, you find out that it all is in timing with their narcotic abuse. So what do I do with them if I operate them and do a Nissen, let's say, a wrap designed to stop reflux, as you all know, but it also prevents burping. They can't vomit, and these patients will vomit at the drop of a hat because the NARCs affect the chemoreceptor trigger zone. They all experience a lower threshold to nausea and vomiting. And you know as well as I do, if they vomit with a fresh wrap in place, they're likely to disrupt it. They'll certainly be miserable. So my first goal in the patient on chronic NARCs is to attempt to get them off. So I play the role a bit of a pain clinic, right at the beginning of a frank discussion with them about their expectations for GERD. And if I can pinpoint it, and it's that simple that it pinpoints with their timing of narcotic abuse, I'm not gonna operate those patients until I've made a bona fide attempt to get them off narcotics or reduce it. So now I gotta go to the pain clinic, talk to the doc. Many times they're very reluctant. They have this contract with their patient. And some of them, the contract excludes discussions with other doctors. They're only gonna talk to their patient about their pain. They won't talk to family members. They won't talk to you. They assume you know nothing about this. This is their baby. And they want you hands off. They want you to just treat this problem, but the problem's related. So I find that it's incredibly complicated for the patient that comes to me on NARCs with a foregut problem. It's gotta be sorted out first.
Yep. And Alex, in your study, it would seem to me that there might be a differential incidence of chronic pain, or at least whether or not they have pain, the chronic narcotic usage with regard to the different approaches to lung cancer resection, robotic, thoracoscopic, thoracotomy. Is there a difference?
So what we found in our patient cohort, it was just over 3,000 patients. There were 59% underwent thoracotomy, 41 underwent VATS of some sort, so video-assisted thoracic surgery, which could include robotic, could include thoracoscopic. And 17.1% that underwent thoracotomy were persistent opioid users compared to only 9.4% of the minimally invasive approaches. And then sort of beyond that, in looking at our multivariable analysis where we determined the independent risk factors, like we said, thoracotomy was a strong one. And so I think it does suggest that it at least warrants further investigation into whether the patients that are getting a larger incision are more prone to persistent opioid use.
Well, I think that's an important point because we all know that a thoracotomy is a big old incision and it is a painful incision. But I think the important thing is to realize that it's not just thoracotomy that causes this, that people who have robotic surgery, who have thoracoscopic surgery, you still have 9%, nearly 10% incidence of post-thoracotomy or what appears to be post-thoracotomy pain.
And that's a great point because to put this in perspective, all prior analyses of other elective operations around the country range 3 to 8% as the rate of new persistent opioid use. The highest is 10% in cancer patients, and that's right about where we are with minimally invasive lung cancer.
So what you're saying is we got them all beat, right? Yeah, exactly.
My question is on the numbers you talked about, yes. Did you make an attempt to exclude those on chronic NARCs coming into it?
Yes. These are all opioid naive patients.
Okay.
No one.
And how
on
many
them.
Did you have to exclude?
So we actually only looked at I don't have that denominator because we only our initial data retrieval was only for opioid naive patients.
I see. So you don't know if it might have been over the national data of 3%. You don't
correct.
Know if that's higher or lower.
We could go back
yep.
and look.
Okay.
David, are there any tips or tricks you would use for the management, the outpatient management? You're sending these people home. First of all, do you limit it? Is it 15 pills for a laparoscopy, 20 for thoracoscopy, 30 for thoracotomy, or do you have a pain management nurse? Is there a hotline they can call? Because you know the problem is it's the 5 p.m. phone call on Friday. Doctor, I'm in pain. I'm dying. I'm in agony. You've got to call me in a prescription. Those sorts of things. How do you handle those practicalities of management?
Sure. So we're in the process of determining what is the correct amount of pills to send someone home for a minimally invasive VASA robotics approach or a traditional thoracotomy approach. And also for foregut esophagectomy and other benign complex esophageal disease. What we did look at was our hospital revisit rate. So those of our patients who came back and had a healthcare utilization event prior to our scheduled outpatient visit. And that includes return to the emergency room, but did not result in a readmission. So they're revisits, not readmissions. Sort of treat and release, as you might say. Mm-hmm. And we looked at the causes of treat and release for esophagectomy patients and lung resection patients. And the most common cause was complaint of pain. So their pain wasn't well controlled and they came back to the ER and were assessed. Now, that shows that there has to be a happy balance. We can't under-treat our patients, right? Because patients may need opioids, right? But we can't over-treat our patients where they have an excess number of pills. And we're in the process of determining that right number.
Okay. Jim, you talked about a little bit about patients who came in already on opioids. Mm-hmm. What about the opioid naive patient? What's your pain management strategy and how do you accomplish not getting them stuck on opioids,
be it a thoracoscopic or laparoscopic
approach?
It's a good point, and I think we're all in the same boat of trying to understand. We don't have great parameters because there's no blood pressure monitor or EKG that tells us, oh, you're not in pain. What do we do? Look at their eyes? I mean, do you talk to their spouse? I mean, is he waking up on pain? You know, you see them sometimes. The classic one is they're asleep in the waiting room. Their eyes are pinpoint, and they wake up as soon as you come in and say, oh.
8 out of 10. I'm 8 out of 10.
So, yeah. You know, some of these you don't know how to manage. So what we've gone to is the naive patient, we used to give 100 for a thoracotomy, 100 Percocets. And then those coming back would get 50. That was our practice 20 years ago. Now we've dropped that back to 50 Percocets for a thoracotomy, 30 for VATS, and approximately that 30 number would hold for a laparoscopic Nissen or whatever. So on a revisit, they're gonna be scrutinized a bit. It's no longer, the nurses don't walk around ever with signed prescription pads. 20 years ago, wouldn't say that was uncommon. I think it did happen. Probably should have never happened, probably did. Never happens today. And for them to get a refill, they're gonna pretty much have to come to the office. Now they may wind up in the ER like you mentioned, but they're pretty much gonna have to come. It's gonna be cut in half at a minimum. And we're gonna try to talk them through it now. We're spending some time talking about, you know, ice pack, physical therapy, Tylenol. Let's try to look at other alternatives for this. And then we'll revisit, was this ever a problem before? We start to get back into, we thought they were maybe naive, and maybe we found out, you know what? When he had his molars out, there were a few problems. So sometimes you gotta dig a little deeper, but that's how we've managed it. We've cut way back. Our refills are much more scrutinized. Now, if they start to come really pushing us for that second, third refill, you know, we wanna make sure we're not missing something. We'll certainly maybe do the extra mile, whether it's getting a CAT scan or whatever, getting a neurology consult. I mean, we got to dig down deeper to see if we're not missing something organic.
Yep.
Like you said, some do need treatment. We don't have a measure of true pain. It's all a gut feeling. But I think we've made a lot of progress just by being aware and making them aware. This isn't candy. You know, there's real poison out there, and we'd like to do anything but give you more narcs. So let's work through the other options, see what we can do. If we run out of options, we're still a little reluctant to send them to the pain clinic unless it's a known pain clinic that's going to work with you. We're afraid that they come out of there like a candy store with a whole cadre of new stuff, worse off than when you sent them. And that was common, still happens sometimes. You got to know your pain clinic before you send them there.
Dave, other options in terms of non-narcotic options, neuroleptics, muscle relaxants, anti-inflammatories, what kind of other strategies are there, both in the acute post-thoracotomy or post-thoracoscopy setting and long-term?
Yeah, so Dr. Lukat has brought up a good point about post-thoracotomy pain and post-thoracotomy pain syndrome. So not all post-thoracotomy pain is relieved by opioids. There's what's called neuropathic post-thoracotomy pain and non-neuropathic post-thoracotomy pain. It's hard to tell which one is which that we're dealing with for patients. There are what are called patient-reported outcome measurements and scales that we can use to figure that out. But really, a clinician should try non-narcotic intervention, something called multimodal analgesia. That includes NSAIDs. And includes neuroleptic agents like Neurontin. And then there are enhanced recovery pathways that utilize special injections of bupivacaine or liposomal bupivacaine at the time of surgery. And then there's pre-incisional interventions. So giving someone Neurontin, Tylenol prior to incision may stabilize the receptors that perceive pain and inhibit the need for opioids down the road.
Well, as much as we've tried to solve the problem here, obviously we're not going to. I think thoracic surgery was unfortunately caught a little flat-footed, just like the rest of America, and we always knew there was an opioid problem. We always knew people were addicted. But in the last year, 18 months, we've been wowed just like everybody else at the number of deaths. It now exceeds the number of gun deaths. It is truly an epidemic. And I think thoracic surgery is now recognizing that. And like any other problem we see, we're going to work the problem, and prevent further people being hooked on opioids and doing the very best we can to get those people we see who are already hooked on opioids off it. But it is a specialty-wide problem and actually a nationwide problem that we're going to have to face. I look forward to maybe in another year seeing talking to you all and seeing what kind of progress we've made and how far we've gotten towards a successful end. I thank you here from the 54th meeting of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons.